Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Oscar Hijuelos. He is the Pulitzer-winning prize novelist of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love. His new memoir is called Thoughts Without Cigarettes, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Friday the 10th of June, at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, good morning to you, and to Santa Fe.
Great to have you on the show. I loved your book when it came out. This was your second novel, but probably most people thought it was your first novel, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love.
Uh-huh.
Many people saw the movie, and it definitely made a big impression. But this is a memoir, and we get to know you in a whole different way. Your mother is from Holguín, Cuba, Santa Fe's sister city, by the way.
Wow.
And your father from Eastern Cuba. You were born and raised in New York. But what I found fascinating and almost unbelievable is that you were kind of detached from your Cuban roots. You were blonde, you were introspective and nearsighted and sickly from an illness, and you didn't dance mambo, and you almost really didn't speak Spanish. What was it like? What was your identity or sense of yourself as a young person?
Wow, that's a really good question. I basically was very aware. I mean, I was extremely aware of my family's Cuban roots and that I was a Cubano, you know. I mean, I heard that all the time. However, I sort of felt in my own household the way I did the first time I went to a hotel at the ripe old age in Spain, in Madrid, Spain, at the ripe old age of 33. And I walked into this hotel, and I thought, in Madrid at 3 in the morning, and I thought, oh, I'm with my roots, and they looked at me like I was crazy. So, you know, I'm going back to my antecedents, and I think as a kid is that I was so oblivious, in a way, to my Cubanness, except in the sense of I felt like I was a visitor, someone dropping in. I had been separated from my family for so long because I'd been in the hospital for a year. I think I was in a state of shock, and it would have been the equivalent of, you know, arriving at this hotel in Madrid or Havana, if you like, and being an American tourist and having the concierge looking at me saying, what are you getting excited about? I mean, I don't think my parents were particularly self-aware or culturally so developed. I mean, in the sense that I don't think the issues that we talk about today, or that I've chosen to talk about in my book, were as pressing or even known to them in that time. I mean, it was the 1950s. I mean, quite frankly, it was before a lot of the social revolutions that most Americans take for granted, like racial equality and, for the most part, a lack of separation between ethnicities in this country. You know, I mean, that was before all that happened. Granted, it was in New York City, which was has always been a funky citadel for different ethnicities. But frankly, as a kid, I knew I was Cuban, but I didn't know really what that was about, except in the sense that it represented a kind of black hole in my life. And as well, I was always a loner. And I think I was a loner because of circumstances. And I would have been, you know, a standout anyway. I mean, I have glimpsed photographs of some distant cousins of mine who were quite blonde and fair, and it's possible that I might have had a different reaction to the way I'd looked growing up had I been born in Holguín or Havana or grown up in Santiago within, you know, pretty much Cuban society. But are you still awake? Because I know it's very early in the morning. you know, I mean, the whole thing is that I I was shell shocked as a kid, and there were no rules of guidance or no wise people running around saying, you know, he was separated from the flock for a while. Let's do our best to bring him back in. I never had that. I just had, you know, he seems to understand what we're talking about, and he's pretty obedient. So let's just have dinner and talk about whatever in Spanish, and, you know, if he wants to pipe in, that's okay.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of poignant passage in the book where you talk about how your father, who loved you very much and whom you loved very much, and you were named after his brother who died, and that's kind of created a special bond and affection. You said, you know, he never actually taught me anything. I was around, but I never quite learned Spanish. I never learned to dance mambo and rumba. They were wonderful at those things. And there's this funny sense of a kind of parenting, which is just like having the kids around, but in a society where you're an immigrant, unless you teach your kids, they're not going to learn it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very interesting notion. I mean, I've talked to about this with my older brother, and sort of, you know, like, you know, in fact, how we sort of came up with absolutely no guidance. And by the way, that's not Charlotte. It's not typically Cuban, you know, not to be, you know, set in a certain direction. But you mentioned dancing the mambo. My father was a great dancer. My mother was, you know, she used to tell me, you know, Joya la reina de la rumba. You know, I was the queen of the rumba in Cuba. But, you know, heaven help her if she actually sat down, you know, took me aside and said, this is what you do. But, you know, I wasn't particularly interested. I mean, I was trying to adjust. I mean, it was kind of weird because I was sort of in this household in which the predominant culture was Cuban, if you like it, or let's say immigrant, if you like. I mean, our newspapers were La Prensa, El Diario, which Spanish language newspaper, as well as the Daily News, which was an English language newspaper. I was very aware of the Sunday funnies. I used to love reading them. I was very aware when they had the, you know, build your body up from a 98-pound weakling to a Superman, the Hercules ads, and
right.
All that kind of stuff. I was also aware of Cuban magazines like La Bohemia, and very vaguely of the first stirrings of the Cuban Revolution, where I remember seeing stories about Fidel Castro and the rebels and the, you know, in the mountains and all this sort of thing when I was a kid. And one particular cover of a Bohemia in which they had sort of a cavalry, a very chivalrous-looking cavalry charging with Cuban flags over a hillside. So my impressions of being Cuban and were, you know, exactly that, just impressionistic, whereas the real mystery to be solved, I mean, you know, in terms of priorities, the Cuban thing wasn't as important to a little kid growing up in New York, at least for my parents' generation, as it was for me to somehow become better at something that they weren't that great at, which is to assimilate into English. And even then, I mean, you know, that was hard because it's not like I went home and I said, oh, Father, have we gone over our lessons in Chaucer tonight? Or, you know, or shall we recite the which part of Byron's poetry have we not gotten to? I mean, it was just non-existent. I went home and, you know, I think I was 8, 9 years old. I mean, we're talking about the 50s, but we didn't have TV sets. We didn't have telephones. I mean, I'm sure there are kids out there who would, you know, I mean, I teach at Duke part of the year, and these kids, like, seem to, you know, these kind of science fiction scenarios of having the internet computers, like, are starting to merge with their bodies, you know. But it's,
right.
When I was a kid, I mean, we had so little, you know, there was so little contact with the outside world in a way that just becoming better at being a New Yorker or New Yorker, you know, that was really a remarkable thing. And I remember feeling second class, you know, I mean, left behind a little bit, always having to play catch up in terms of learning English and arithmetic and basic lessons. Because the fact is, when I went home, neither my mother or father were either available or capable of you know, going over things like, you know, how do you diagram a sentence in English, that sort of thing that, you know, you learn when you're a kid, if you're in a decent school anyway.
Yeah.
My brother, I don't remember being very helpful to me, except, like, maybe hitting me, punching me around every now and then. But, I mean, the point is that the job I was applying for as a child in my state of confusion was that of a fairly adequate New York City English-speaking and reading student, as opposed to the bicultural thing, which, you know, from our perspective now, where, you know, you turn on a TV, a cable TV with 500 channels and 7 or 8, you know, Spanish language stations at any given time. When I was a kid, when we had a TV, there was no such thing, you know. And,
right.
And so, you know, I grew up in a very nice household that was overwhelmingly Cuban in many ways, and yet I think it was sort of like being in, okay, we have to you have to find your way to this outside world. And I should have had some more coffee this morning, but obviously hyper enough, but you know what I'm saying, it was just very I felt my upbringing was quite confused.
We're talking to author Oscar Hijuelos. I was reading this book, and you know, you open a memoir of an artist, and sometimes you find this burning ambition from early childhood to do that art form or whatever. And in your life, it was quite different. You found your direction toward being a writer in a much more, I don't know, it's like kind of desultory way, just step by step. How did it happen?
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, I never thought I would succeed at being a writer. Wanting to become a writer is an entirely different thing. I believe that I was in, I was attending a community college in the Bronx, and I think I had a very kindly professor, his name was Wertheim, as a matter of fact, and he pointed out a phrase I had put into an essay that actually literally said the words were freely frolicking. I have no idea what the essay was about, but I remember him circling it and saying, "You're show a gift for language here," and well done, you know, with like 3 exclamation points. And I never forgot that. And so somehow when I was in school, I sort of started developing this attitude that maybe I could possibly write. And I was a pretty good essay writer, and I did great on term papers and all that, because I was, I'm obsessive compulsive, so I'll go over things a million times to make sure they're right. And I was like that as a kid. But I never thought I would be a creative writer. And the only, I could spend a half an hour explaining how I eventually sort of started writing creatively. I mean, on one hand, I had a girlfriend who was an actress, and I used to see a lot of theater. And at a certain point, I said to myself, you know, I could do that too, write plays. I also started reading far more in college, and I had sort of, I could do that as well. But, you know, in terms of my role models, when I was reading in college, there were no Latinos out there writing, so it was more like, once again, I was from the outside looking in, or, you know, and I felt always apart. I could never in a million years have predicted that I would be a writer, because even when I did start writing, it was more out of, I will develop this noble way of passing my spare hours in life as I get older and do something else for a living. At the time, I thought I would be a school teacher. My brother taught high school for 30 years. It's no, you know, he's very proud of it, and it was a great job, good benefits, et cetera. And I never thought in a million years that I would attract the attention of well-known writers like, at the time, Donald Barthelme and Susan Sontag at City College, and they just really liked my work, and they thought I had something going. I didn't see it, but, you know, I didn't take much encouragement to keep me going on something, and I think I was encouraged just enough at a certain moment in my development in my early 20s to keep going, but even then, I never had a big ego about it, and I always thought everyone else, as I did in regular classes, I always thought everyone was smarter than me. I thought, you know, they had a lot. lot easier time crunching numbers in math or chemistry or whatever, you know, whatever the subject was. And I just thought everybody was far swifter. I mean, it's hard to explain. I just, you know, the big riddle for me is I have a two-part question. It's like I think I had somewhat of an inferiority complex growing up. And I think part of it had to do with the way I was, you know, childhood trauma and all that, you know, being separated at an early age from my family for so long. And not to harp on this, but it seems actually, the more I've thought about it, it seems to be the only reasonable explanation. Also the fact that we were fairly, you know, modestly living and so forth. But then I wonder how much of it has to do with, you know, what I would call the prevalent attitude that Latinos are so generally different or not quite as part of the mainstream melting pot, as it were, as, say, other groups. Like Italians, I felt, growing up, were much more accepted than New York Latinos, you know, even though, you know, there's the mafia and all these mythologies about them. I mean, you know, the mythologies in New York about Latinos when I was growing up were, you know, the West Side Story gang members, you know, heroin, that, you know, or the Latin lover on the other extreme. It wasn't, there were no, you know, there was not like Borges or Carlos Fuentes or, you know, Sandra Cisneros or, you know, whatever, whoever you want to count as a role model in terms of art. So in my very roundabout way to answer your question, and not to put everybody back to sleep, but I mean, basically it's all, you know, we're talking now from the perspective of a value system that's been in place for a while now in terms of our lives and looking, you know, we have social perspectives that, you know, we can look back through history. But at the time, it was like being in a sort of very socially unself-aware, unaware state and living in a world that I felt, frankly, outside of Latinos, was largely indifferent, you know, to the Latino thing. And in New York in particular, there were so many ethnic groups already, you know, vying for success, what I would call this success space or a space in which to be successful, that, you know, let me tell you, you want to have a spend a good couple of weeks, go to a New York City public high school in 1970 and, you know, and see how much fun you'd have. I mean, different world, you know. So
right.
I have no idea how I became a writer.
Well, I mean, another thing, you've found these mentors who encouraged you, and that mm-hmm. was a part of it. And but what I think what was interesting too is that you were writing this very what you might call non-ethnic fiction, and then you reconnected somehow with your Cuban roots and ended up writing in such a passionate and intimate way about your characters, who were musicians and immigrants and in New York and in the United States. What was that process like for you of reconnecting with that stuff or connecting with it?
You know, Charlotte, that's such a good question. I mean, I'm not quite sure if I wrote about non-ethnic issues. I think I always wrote about certain elements that I'd grown up with, you know, working class people and certain hardships and vices, if you like. I mean, my first novel, Our House in the Last World, I have some line that I still like to this day, which goes, you know, just about everybody in the neighborhood, all the fathers were alcoholics, and it was really true. I don't recall walking into an apartment when I was a kid growing up and seeing a father who is, well, you know, I don't imbibe myself, but please have a, you know. I mean, these guys, they came home from the rotten jobs, and they just wanted to get, you know, go on their instant vacation. And so, I mean, I think what happened is that in terms of subject matter, I wrote about working class things at first. I was very naturalistic, but I always felt it kind of chill, and I felt a little alienation. Artistically speaking, when I was writing about something and not talking about my roots, if I wasn't talking about my Cubanness, if someone Cuban, I felt, it's ironic because I felt, it, you know, the same moment when I felt kind of apart from it, if I were trying to write about it and I did not include that from which I had always been distancing myself, the piece would feel false and cold. And as I got a little older, and, you know, I mean, I love literature, and believe me, I love literature of every kind. I mean, I love English literature. I mean, British, you know, born. And, you know, one of my favorite writers coming up was D.H. Lawrence. I thought he was great. I loved Conrad because he was crazy and he used to pelt people with bread balls at dinner and, you know, but Yeats, all those guys. But I also, in a New York school writers, I just love. But, you know, what happened is I started feeling this warmth and affinity. Pieces started to feel more whole to me once I started dealing with that, which I'd probably on some level been kind of trying to duck for some time, which was my Cubanness, Latinness, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, the fact is it coincided with another self-perception in my life as I got a little older in my 20s, and I was either a very jokey guy or a very dead serious person. And, you know, the colder the world feels to you, the outside world, the stuff that warms your heart, that gives you security, that it remains a touchstone, is the stuff that nurtures your soul. And in my case, as I was writing, I just found that when I wrote about Cubans, I felt really happy. I never claimed to be a big expert. I never even knew if I got it all right, but it really inspired me, and that's how it went.
We're talking to author Oscar Hijuelos. Now, you were surprised one day to come home and find an envelope, and it turned out you were awarded a year-long fellowship at the American Academy in Rome, and that's where you wrote The Mambo Kings. What was the influence, I mean, you talk about this a little bit in the memoir, which I thought was lovely, of the influence of Rome on that book?
Well, I mean, Charlotte, I wrote my first novel when I had a full-time job. For any of you aspiring writers out there, it can be done on the evenings and the weekends. And this would include the same rule, I guess, would apply to adulterers, potential adulterers, but it's better to write novels. If you have a full-time job, I did it, and I published the first novel. It was very respectfully received. New York Times review, which was a big deal, won a couple of minor grants with it, made a big, I think, over 4 or 5 years work, $4,000. But I was still riding the subways, and I think I was coming home in a very dank, cold, miserable February evening in New York, riding the number one subway uptown on the West Side, and dark, you know, one of those New York lost winter nights where you just feel like killing yourself, and, you know, and I was holding on to a cabin pole and wondering if this was the same one that my father used to hold on to when he'd come home from work, and really blue, and I came home, and I went to my mailbox, and it's going through, you know, the usual Con Edison, you know, power bills and this and that. And then I come to an envelope from the American Institute of Arts and Letters. Never heard of them. I'll open it up, look through it. It's a letter that says, young man, dear sir, if you were offered a year's residency in a villa in Rome with a travel allowance and a monthly stipend and a studio and you know, et cetera, would you be willing to accept? And, you know, that was a complete. That didn't take me very long to figure out, and you know, in April I was, you know, riding the subways, wondering about my future. And so you wrote a novel. You're not an academic teacher. You're not, you know, running off to work for the Paris Review or whatever young writers did. And I still had my full-time job. And by September I was walking along the Gianicolo in Rome. And it was like I had gone from, not that I hated my life in New York. It was quite, you know, it was quite wonderful most of the time. But when it was horrible, it was absolutely, you know, awful. And there I was suddenly, 6 months later, walking around in these beautiful, you know, wisteria blooming streets in Rome and perfume in the air. And, you know, and I was hearing Italian and trying to learn Italian and, you know, and being confronted with a culture that I knew sort of like peripherally from a distance, you know, Italians. I love Italians, you know, beautiful people. But it's quite a different story from running into a friend from Howard Beach and having a nice Easter, you know, dinner with an Italian family and actually, you know, going to a market and trying to learn and communicate with people and have conversations. So I, ironically enough, it was liberating to me because I was separated from my normal life in New York. And on the other hand, I began to feel what my parents must have felt like coming to the States, which is they too were confronted with their otherness, and or at least that was my fantasy. So in Rome, I somehow, it was the perfect place for me to work on, you know, the Mambo Kings. And in fact, I pretty much think there are strips and stretches of Trastevere, you know, with some government buildings and so forth that remind me or resembled in my mind's eye the grand architecture of what I perceived as the grand and sort of classic architecture of Havana, and, you know, the palm trees and the little gardens and the sort of mellow outdoorness of it all. And even though, the, you know, the salsa thing wasn't happening in Italy the way it did, you know, like, it was very weird when I got there in 86, you know, you never saw the word mambo. In 1991, a year after the book came out, you know, my book came out in Italy, too. Suddenly you were seeing mambo disquettes and you know, mambo kings play this and that being sold off of kiosks in Rome. You know, I mean, you know, pirated versions of, you know, how to dance the mambo and stuff like that. I mean, I had no idea that as I would be walking the streets of Rome and taking things in and just checking it, like some gypsies would come along and be jamming in an alley or some sidewalk singer would be trying to enchant you in the Piazza of Santa Maria di Trastevere and that kind of thing. I mean, I, you know, it was all wonderful, and it was so different from what I had known for the last, you know, I mean, subway job. I mean, riding subways and working in Midtown ad agency, suddenly I was sort of in this paradise. And part of it was just being young and dumb. You know, I mean, frankly, you could catch malaria and fall down six flights of stairs, and if you wake up the next morning feeling halfway all right, it's, you remember it fondly. But I had a wonderful time in the city, but I was always very acutely aware of my otherness, and I think that helped me understand probably what my parents' generation went through, and therefore what my Mambo Kings would end up going through. Although, one final note about this whole thing is I was very liberated in the sense I never really thought that I was working on a book that would be published one day.
Well, that's the thing I found amazing, is that you would sort of stop writing at moments because you didn't think anybody would be interested. But you're saying that was liberating? I mean, what kept you going?
Look, you know, I mean, the... Charlotte, I mean, the hardest thing, I don't know if you write fiction. I imagine you sound like someone who does. Somehow I have a fantasy of you writing fiction, but I don't know why. You have a very concern. You have a very serious concern in your voice, so I'm fantasizing about you as that, you know?
We will leave it as a mystery. We will leave it as a mystery to our listeners out in Radio Land.
Okay, well, listeners out in Radio Land, I mean... The whole thing is when you're writing what I learned when I was first writing my first novel. I'm sorry to be so redundant. Our House in the Last World. First of all, you have this. If you're a serious person and you buy the dream of literature, which is that even though you may not last very long, what you are writing may affect people in a way that will have a far, you know, more reaching effect. I don't even think anybody will be, you know, so much vanity. I mean, 100 years, maybe I'll be in a footnote somewhere in some cyber library in the Twilight Zone of the future, in which you walk into some guy's mansion and he'll show you his, you know, drawing room. It'll be filled with old, Kindle, you know, those Kindle things.
Kindles, right.
Hundreds, thousands of them, you know, all filled with, like, numerous novels, and it'll be all abstraction. But, you know, I mean, quite frankly, I had a very noble idea about literature. And when I wrote my first book, I could have only have written it had I considered it a very intimate process, in that I was communicating with my writers, with my readers and as a writer, and that I was, you know, it was like having a very private conversation with myself that I was sharing, and yet I, at the time, I was never really aware of its public nature, because once the book gets published and you meet other people, your readers, and it's quite different. It's just, you just realize, you know, hey, it wasn't just this noble, you know, kind of fantasy of you know, reaching out to the artistic legacy of mankind, you know, this kind of daydream that keeps young folks going. It's a real entity. I could not have written my first novel had I thought it would have been read so publicly. Having said that, I thought I was not a very literary writer, and as such, while I had my full-time job, even though I went to Rome, I had this notion that I was practicing, I was learning how to write, and you know, so my job, in a way, was to keep on doing studies and painting and doing portraitures, as you were, and I was accumulating fragments. It was like I was learning how to riff. I've always thought that writing my first novel was akin to learning a fairly decent amount of piano and composition, and it's kind of formal, and it has certain things going on with it that are unique to my voice at that time and my emotions, but mostly I saw the Mambo Kings in what I was writing. On one hand, yes, it was self-expression and it was satisfying and I ran with it. On the other hand, I really just thought it was to learn the craft so I could get to the point to write a real book. And I'll tell you, Charlotte, I was so negative. Plus nobody was publishing Latinos, not in New York anyway. I know that the Southwest has always had, you know, university and local presses, but I'm talking about, you know, national houses publishing Latino writers. It just wasn't happening. And so it was kind of liberating in a way. I just didn't think anyone would publish the book, so I wrote whatever the F I felt like writing. It's part of my language. And the other thing is that you know, at one point I stopped to write this piece of junk that I thought, you know, you should do, instead of being out there and in people's faces and putting your emotions, you know, being blunt. This happened, that happened, this is what he felt. I got into this sort of very prissy, you know, very mannered style of, you know, quote, what I call literary writing with a capital L, you know, in which every delicate dollop of dulcetory prose is, you know, delivered with such, I mean, you know, I pick, I have the fiction I pick up to this day, which comes out of, you know, one graduate school or the other, is just so mannered and phony to me, and that, you know, I feel that way now, and I felt the same way back when.
And your agent said it was the worst thing that she'd ever read.
Yeah. And basically I went to lunch with her. I showed her this, quote, literary novel, and she said, this is the worst thing I've ever read in my life. And I said, thank you, God. Because I was going through the motions, and I was going through what I think a lot of Latinos go through in terms of their identity, which is, I'm not going to be me. I'm not going to write about me. I'm not going to write about where I came from. I'm going to put out, you know, this is the real thing, you know, this kind of juicy language that's, you know, reverent and lyric and all this crap. And it wasn't real. It fell falsely. And that was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. I mean, I threw away some, you know, a good amount of time at work, but I just went back to working on Mambo Kings after that. And it really clicked. Again, I felt elated. And I felt I was being true to myself, and it was all a surprise to me.
We're talking to author Oscar Ijuelos about his new memoir, Thoughts Without Cigarettes. So this book, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love, was your second novel. It was a gigantic success. It was an international success. You were suddenly just a celebrity in this literary scene. And until that time, I mean, it's the tone of the memoir is really interesting and kind of, fun and amusing for me because it's so self-deprecating in a certain way. I mean, when you talk about this book, which so many people have read and made such an impression on so many people's lives and was a book of its time and everything, you didn't accept the first offer on it because it wasn't enough to pay down some debts that you'd been trying to pay. Suddenly you were this international celebrity and not only a writer, but suddenly a representative of the entire Latino community instead of just a representative of yourself. What was that like?
It was kind of weird. I mean, you know, I'm very blonde, fair, and my Spanish, when I do speak it, is, depending on my mood and so forth, is it could be awful or it could be very nice or it could be, you know, accented terribly or depending on how much exposure I recently had to it. But, yeah, it was kind of weird. It's kind of weird being on a live talk show in Sweden on television, and the host comes on and is looking at the pundits. He's looking for the Cuban guy, and you look like the Cuban guy looks just like the Swedes, or, you know, that the Caucasian thing, or whatever you want to call it. I found it very hard. I mean, on so many levels. You know, the Latino thing, I mean, you know, I mean, in Europe, it's not a big deal. This, I mean, there are problems with immigration and you know, now they're dealing with an extra element of, you know, possible terrorism. And, you know, their issues have been more about very insular societies letting in outsiders. And so when Mambo Kings came out, for example, and it was dealing with immigration issues in, very indirectly, Sweden was first starting to let in, you know, I guess, foreign elements. And, of course, you know, over the years, the crime has gone up, et cetera, et cetera. But back then they were trying to look for, you know, the model. So I would find myself on these TV shows in Sweden being asked about immigration and frankly, and how to solve, and when you have a society that's developing problems because of differences between different cultural groups, how does one seek a solution? Of course, you know, the Europeans are beautiful and wonderful people, and they're very intellectual, and they love talking over stuff, but that's the last thing I felt prepared to talk about. I mean, I could talk about my parents' experience, my own experience. I think that, you know, I mean, I think language is a definer of identity to a certain extent. I think in terms of people's notions, skin color and stuff like that definitely is. I mean, I used to get jumped by, you know, Latinos who didn't know what I was about. I used to overhear whiteys talking, bad-mouthing Latinos growing. I mean, you know, I was kind of like a spy. Moving through both ranks, does that make me an expert on being white, or does that make me an expert on being a Latino? No. But being on the road and, you know, explaining to the German, oh, I think Ireland, you know, the German people, like, you know, they have always been very aware of histories and people's histories and what they're about. So to me, you know, my humility never turned me into the kind of super salesman for, I guess, the themes of my work that I might have become. On the other hand, I've never tried to be false about anything. I found it very unusual and kind of crazy at times. You have to remember, I mean, the best part of touring for me, as a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, the first Latino was traveling the country, the United States, where, I mean, you know, the community turned out for me, and they just really, you know, they really, you know, I just felt so happy and so proud I did something right in my life, you know. And the Latinos all over the country really were very, I think, heartened by that. I mean, you know, this is 20 years later, so it's hard. Possibly, it's hard for a lot of people to imagine that how closed out American Latinos were from the, you know, the notions of literature, but it was absolutely the case.
Yeah, well, that's something I wanted to ask you about. I mean, that you have this world in which Latino fiction or films even are considered kind of like a subcategory, but you don't have New England fiction, say, being some subcategory. I mean, that's the mainstream. And in the last 20 years, to what extent do you think Latino stories have taken their place as American stories, whether it be film or literature?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I've heard some. I mean, you know, we have new successes like Juno Diaz, who I ran into in Puerto Rico not so long ago. Great guy, wonderful talent. I love the guy, and you know, God bless him. But you know, when you consider that something I read recently that one in four, you know, school students, pupils in American schools are Latino, and if you think about the proportion of Latino writers who are well known to the country, as opposed to the writers who you know are. You know, if you have discussions about writing in New York, it's not about Juno Diaz or Oscar Iguelos or Sandra Cisneros. It's about Jonathan Lethem and, you know, Jonathan Safran Foer and these other brilliant entities. You know, I'm sure they're wonderfully talented writers. I like their work, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a subconscious, I'm convinced there's a subconscious prejudicial thing working against Latinos in this country.
How does it compare to African-American literature?
You know, the African-American the African-American folks have always had it over the Latinos as a writing group and as a reading block, because it's not like, you know, American Latinos will say, you know, I'm Dominican or I'm Puerto Rican, I'm, you know, I'm Cuban, I'm one half Mexican, I'm one half Venezuelan, I'm this and that alien or whatever, you know. You don't hear African Americans saying, "Well, you know, I'm introducing William Melvin Kelly, who's of the Dahomey tribe, you know, or you know, is from the Yoruban." I mean, there's a subdivision thing in American Latino letters in terms of nationality that makes this, you know, makes the cogent literary scene akin to the black letter scene. You know, it's just there's no comparison, because you know, African American writers as a group do not they do not specialize, or they're not set aside. You know, we don't talk about Ralph Ellison in a certain way. We never talked about August Wilson in a certain way. You just don't talk about Charles Johnson in a certain way. But you do talk about Chicano writers, Tejano writers, Puerto Rican writers, Dominican writers. You know, there's something about Latino identity in the United States that is sort of, we're not a part of the mainstream, but on the other hand, within our own entity, there's so many subdivisions, so many, you know, and proud, you know, rightly so and properly so. But I think it's hard to get, you know, present to the general reading public this cogent image of one vital, you know, constant voice. In fact, we're so varied and so unique that it's, you know, it's a hard sell. I mean, there's no definitive Latino, and that's one of the points of my work, you know. I mean, let's face it, I mean, Mambo Kings had a lot of his success because of the hook, in a way, of the Americans' love affair with the I Love Lucy show. And,
right,
you know,
right.
Those crazy Cuban guys who would go on there. And, you know, quite frankly, I always loved that show because it reminded me of the folks who'd come into our apartment, et cetera, et cetera. But it turned out that, you know, that was a hook. And I think that, you know, for... African-American, I mean, you know, history. I mean, there's so much a part of American history in a way that, you know, always puts their literature in, it's very important. But I also think Latinos are, and our legacy and our heritage is important as well. But it's defining it that is the job of the writers. And so that's what I think we've been in the process of.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, it'll be interesting to have this same conversation 10, 15, 20 years from now as well, because this is very much of an evolution. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, in a book like this, in a memoir, you have so many choices because you don't have the same kind of narrative arc as in a novel necessarily. What to include and what to leave out? How did you think about that when you were writing Thoughts Without Cigarettes?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the thing is that the irony is for me is that Thoughts Without Cigarettes is just the tip of a much larger narrative iceberg that I could have put together. I mean, I felt I had to restrain myself as opposed to search desperately for material. But choosing, I mean, the hardest thing about a memoir is choosing or deciding which events do you care to point out and somehow present as being meaningful to a certain time in your life, you know? I mean, I don't know if getting jumped in a parking lot when I was 18 years old by a bunch of black kids because I was dumb enough to use it as a, housing project's shortcut was in emblematic of my life at that time, but I think it says a lot about what an idiot I was. And you know, the fact that I chose it over possible other incidents, created at the moment an aesthetic problem, which is maybe you had other things you wanted to say in other ways or with other kinds of scenes. How can you bring that all and, you know, have them converge in this little situation, you know? And so I think that's the hardest thing. You choose the event, you know, first of all, if you get beyond, if I had tried writing the same book 20 years ago, would have probably had different events and different details because I remember things more vividly back when. But as of now, you decide, you choose your material as it occurs to you, and you try to confer upon it values that will hopefully inform the rest of the book, you know, and that's what I was trying to do. So
was it, it must have been a hard act to follow. You're in your late 30s, you win the Pulitzer Prize. Where do you go from there? And the book ends there, which is I found interesting, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I responded to Mambo Kings with a book written almost entirely in female language, which not a single reviewer noticed in this country. It was all about, you know, immigrant, touching immigrant story. I don't know. I could have written Godzilla Means King Kong, and they would have called it an immigrant tale. But, I wrote a novel, what I considered from the perspective of, feminist ideals and emotions, and it was so shocking to anyone who'd read Mambo Kings with his machista, atmosphere that hardly anyone got it. I mean, the thing is being a Latino writer, you're often, the outward architecture, which may have to do indeed with some elements of immigration and this and that, They're confused with the contents of the interior, and I have found it frustrating at times that people, judge my books literally by their outward structures as opposed to looking at the delicacy and beauty and the soulfulness of the language and all that crap, which is what they do with a lot of non-Latino writers. It turns my stomach, as a matter of fact. I don't want to name names, but let me tell you, it really pisses me off. So, folks, I hope I'm not offending you out there, but I mean it. You know, Latino writers have a rough time, and I've decided this, with this memoir, I'm beginning a campaign to get Latino writers and Latino readership out there again and to bring back, a sense of solidarity and...
Yeah.
And, that's what I look forward to doing. Are you still awake out there in TV land? I mean, radio land?
Yeah, no, but it's time to go. Oscar Ijuelos is a Pulitzer Prize winning author of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love. His memoir is called Thoughts Without Cigarettes, and he is speaking tomorrow night at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. It's just great to be with you. Thanks for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, and I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of your presence and your questions.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.